Convention on Combating of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill.
Chair, thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. With the Prevention and Combating of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill. I think if the officials can start with a briefing, which would please take you through the slide presentation, I'll add some points at the end before there are comments from members of the committee. And, I think everybody, whether it's Ms. Kale Pele, the DDG, Constitutional Development, leading the team.
Chair and all present. We'll move straight to the presentation. The purpose of the bill. The bill seeks to address the increasing number of incidents motivated by prejudices in the form of hate crimes and hate speech, and to assist persons who are victims thereof. The bill creates the offences of hate crimes and hate speech and puts in place measures to prevent and combat these offences. The bill can be linked directly to a number of key targets in the National Development Plan, most notably the need for sustained campaigns against racism, sexism, homophobia, and xenophobia, and that all people are and feel safe. The most significant provisions of the bill requiring elaboration are discussed. Mr. Bassett will take us through the clause-by-clause provisions of the bill.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. Let's start off where we normally start off, and that's Clause 1 that contains definitions. I'm not going to go through all the definitions, but highlight just a few. I think it's important to note that the...
Before you do that, now, are you taking us through the bill or through the summary?
We prepared a presentation which is a summary of the bill in the PowerPoint presentation.
I thought that you were going to give us a summary because if we are going to be doing the bill itself, I thought that belongs to another session. Mm.
Chair, we'll be doing an overview of the bill. It's not a clause by clause, but just an overview of the bill.
Okay.
We will explain the clause, some of the highlight some of the clauses.
Yes. I think the summary is very helpful because they are really introducing us to what you are putting for us and not explaining a bill as such. Okay. If I may continue, I just want to highlight possibly two definitions, and the one it's important to note that the definition of court excludes district courts in the magistrates' courts. So matters arising out of the application of this bill or act when it becomes one can only be dealt with in the High Court and can only be dealt with in the regional courts. Question has been raised, but why? And our answer to that is that we feel that the judicial officers and the court officials and the prosecutors and everybody else in the regional courts are more geared up to deal with complex issues of this nature, sensitive issues of this nature, and that is why there's a limitation and these matters can only be dealt with in the regional courts and the high courts. Clause 2 really just sets out the objects of the bill that I would like to think are pretty self-explanatory, and I'm not going to go into any detail as far as that's concerned. Clauses 3 and 4 are the most important in the bill because they create crimes. They create the offences of hate crimes and hate speech. That's the cornerstone, the foundation of the bill. Now, for the first time in our history, we have statutory offences that deal with conduct that is based on various forms of intoleration. And to start off with the hate crime in Clause 3, it's committed if a person commits any recognized offense under any law and that's commonly referred to as the base crime or base offence. And if a person commits any offence and the commission of that offence is motivated by prejudice or intolerance on the basis of one or more characteristics or perceived characteristics that are listed in the bill against a victim, a family member of the victim, or the victim's association with or support for a group of persons who share the said characteristics is guilty of a hate crime. So if you commit an offence and that offence is motivated by prejudice or intolerance, you can be convicted of what will be called the offence of a hate crime. And I think it's also important to note that in Clause 3 and in Clause 4, a prosecution can only be instituted with the authority approval of the Director of Public Prosecutions, which has jurisdiction in that particular area. So a decision will be taken at a very high level whether a prosecution can be instituted or not. This is a safeguard to ensure that frivolous matters don't bog down the courts with matters that shouldn't be dealt with, and that only matters that constitute hate crimes and hate speech in the strict sense of the word and the circumstances deserve the adjudication thereof by our courts. So the Deputy Director General of Director of Public Prosecutions having jurisdiction or person delegated here by him or her must authorise the prosecution. Clause 4 deals with the offence of hate speech. Now we realise that this is perhaps a bit more controversial than hate crimes, if we judge by what has been said in the media. Clause 4 creates the offence of hate speech, and subsection or subclause 1A provides that any person who intentionally publishes, propagates or advocates anything or communicates to any to one or more persons in a manner that could reasonably be construed to demonstrate a clear intention to be harmful or to incite harm or to promote or propagate hatred based on, and there's a whole list of things, based on a whole list of things, is guilty of the offence of hate speech. Now let me go through that list. It's age, albinism, birth, colour, culture, disability, ethnic or social origin, gender or gender identity, HIV status, language, nationality, or migrant or refugee status, race, religion, sex, which includes intersex, or sexual orientation. Now please note that these are in alphabetical order, so they're not in any order of prominence or dominance. They are arranged in alphabetical order. So that is what hate speech is about. And Clause 4.1b goes further and creates an offence when hate speech material is intentionally distributed or made available in cyberspace. South Africa has experienced this on numerous occasions, and this is intended to address this scourge. Clause 4.1c provides that any person who intentionally displays any material or makes available any material which constitutes hate speech, which is accessible by or directed at a specific person who can consider to be a victim of hate speech, is guilty of an offence. Now I'm getting to a very important portion of Clause 4.2, and I'd like to draw members' attention to this, because this contains exemptions. What is not hate speech? Some people I see in commentators refer this to defences. And Clause 4.2 is important because it exempts certain communications from criminal sanction as contemplated in Clause 4.1. So if these criteria apply, a person cannot be convicted of hate speech. The exemptions are found in Clause 4.2a to c of the bill and confirm the right to freedom of expression as enshrined in Section 16.1 of the Constitution, which includes freedom of the press and other media, freedom to receive or impart information or ideas, freedom of artistic creativity and academic freedom and freedom of scientific research. Now, these provisions, if I had to read Section 16.1 of the Constitution, you'd recognize them. They come from the Constitution. Section 16.1 provides that everyone has the right to freedom of expression, and the right does not extend to propaganda for war, imminent incitement of imminent violence, advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. I beg your pardon, I should be concentrating on Section 16.1. Everyone has the right to freedom of expression, which includes the freedom of the press and other media, freedom to receive or impart information or ideas, freedom of artistic creativity and academic freedom, and freedom of scientific research. So what is in the bill you'll find in the Constitution. These provisions weren't in the bill that was sent out for comments because it was thought that they are covered in the Constitution. The comments that we received, thousands of comments that we received, expressed a concern that our bill goes too far. And it was thought that it was prudent to set out in the bill and reaffirm what the Constitution says in terms of exemptions. So clause 4.2.8c really reaffirms what you find in the Constitution. Clause 4.2d is very important because it includes, from the ambit of hate speech, any bona fide interpretation and proselytizing or espousing of any religious tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine, or writings. Artistic creativity or performance or espousal of religious doctrine that will not qualify, I want to add, for exemption from hate speech. If it advocates hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm based on any of the protected grounds. And this goes back to Section 16.2, which I read by mistake a few minutes ago. The right to freedom of expression does not extend to propaganda for war, incitement of violence, or, importantly, advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that it constitutes incitement to cause harm. So we've got the exemptions in the bill now, and the clause 4.2d, which relates to the religious aspect and protection of communications of certain religious doctrine, is new. And that came about as a result of thousands, tens of thousands, many in the form of petitions, from the religious communities in South Africa, expressing concern that the bill, without something like that, would give rise to unintended consequences and have a limitation on freedom of religion. Let me leave clause 4 there and go on to clause 5. In the interest of time, I might just gloss over some of these provisions. They are self-explanatory. Clause 5 sets out what a victim impact statement is, namely a sworn statement by the victim which reflects physical, psychological, social, economic, or any other consequences of a hate crime or hate speech on a victim, and the contents of a victim impact statement will be admissible as evidence in court unless good cause to the contrary is shown. Clause 6 is also important because it sets out the penalties and orders that a court can make when a person has been convicted of one of these two offences. Clause 6.1 deals with a person that's convicted of a hate crime. And a person who's convicted of a hate crime is subject to the penalties set out in Section 276 or 297 of the Criminal Procedure Act. But it's subject to the criminal jurisdiction of that court. If I might remind members that Section 276 of the Criminal Procedure Act provides the sentencing options which a court may impose. And these are imprisonment, periodical imprisonment, fine, and correctional supervision. Section 297 of the Criminal Procedure Act provides for the conditional or unconditional postponement or suspension of sentences, cautions, and reprimands. So in terms of Section 297, the court can also give suspended sentences. In terms of the bill, if a person is convicted of a hate crime which is not subject to the minimum sentencing regime, and in the case of any damage, injury, or loss of income or support, the court must regard the fact that the person has been convicted of a hate crime as an aggravating circumstance. A fine or imprisonment for a period. So that is as far as hate crimes are concerned. So a court's discretion for a hate crime is vast, because the court can impose any sentence depending on the base crime and the circumstances it is committed. A base crime could range from common assault right up to murder. So the penalties would be based on the type of base crime that is committed within the jurisdiction, penal jurisdiction of the court. That's as far as hate crimes is concerned. For hate speech, it is suggested in the bill that a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 3 years in the case of a first conviction, or a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years in the case of a subsequent conviction, may be imposed for a conviction for hate speech. We looked at the sentencing regimes in other countries, and this is based to some extent on what we found in our research. The comments that we received on the bill that we sent out for comments prior to this bill suggested that we were far too, we were heavy-handed in terms of the proposed sentences for hate speech. I think for a second or subsequent conviction it was suggested to be 10 years, that has now been brought down to 5 years. So if we can move then on to clause 6. This deals with alternatives to fines, and I can just get there. Also on clause 6, which we're busy with at the moment, the question arose when we were preparing this bill in the first place is whether there's a place for restorative justice measures in this bill. Now, this is a very divided question. There are lots of people that say, yes, there should be restorative justice measures, and others that say, no, there shouldn't. The bill doesn't make provision specifically for any restorative justice measures. Because the question has been raised, and I suppose will continue to be raised, whether a restorative justice measure, for instance, like diversion or any other form, has a place in South Africa when you consider what these offences are about and the implications of the offences that are committed, particularly hate crimes. But there is scope if presiding officers use Section 297 of the Criminal Procedure Act to impose suspended sentences with various conditions. So there is scope using the existing law to be innovative and come up with sentences that can be that suit the circumstances of all sorts of cases. I'm going to deal with clauses 7 and 8 briefly. Clause 7 deals with directives, and it requires the NDPP, after consultation with the DG Justice and the National Commission of South African Peace Service, to issue directives on relevant matters, and these directives must be complied with by prosecutors in execution of their functions under the bill. Clause 8 deals with reporting on the implementation of the bill, and this is important so that we can start gathering reliable information on what is happening in South Africa as far as hate speech and hate crimes are concerned. So clause 8 requires the minister, after consultation with the minister responsible for policing and the NDPP, to make regulations on the information that is to be collected and collated. This information then must, I think, on an annual basis be made available to Parliament, to chairpersons of the SA Human Rights Commission, Commission for Gender Equality, and the Commission for the Promotion and Protection of the Rights of Cultural, Religious and Linguistic Communities. If I may deal with clauses 9 and 10. Clause 9 deals with the prevention of hate crimes and hate speech, and requires the state to promote awareness of the prohibition against these offences aimed at prevention and combating thereof, and training is going to be crucial in the implementation of this proposed legislation, including social context training programs, which must be developed by the state and SAJA on the prohibition, prevention and combating of hate crimes and hate speech. I think it's a very important aspect. This training of judicial officers and court officials and other officials involved in dealing with these offences. If I may then go on to clause 10, which empowers the minister to make certain regulations in order to achieve the objects of the bill. I think that's pretty straightforward. And then clause 11 deals with the short provision, but it must be read with the annexure to the bill, which contains consequential amendments to the bill. I'm not going to go into those in detail. They are quite technical, but basically we amend in the schedule Criminal Procedure Act, dealing with the bail schedule. We amend the Criminal Law Amendment Act, dealing with compulsory minimum sentences, and we amend Schedule 3 to the Child Justice Act, which deals with serious offences committed by children. So the offences, the amendments that we bring about to these three acts are only in respect of hate crimes. They do not apply in respect of hate speech. I think it's important that I do deal with financial implications. Money is tight. I don't have to say that. There's no additional budget to implement the legislation. The department has worked on point of departure has been that this bill will have to be implemented within existing budgets. And we will piggyback, I think, to the extent that we possibly can on the implementation of the National Action Plan Against Racism. I want to highlight that this bill has been subject to an enormous amount of public consultation. I have referred to a previous version of the bill that was published for comments in October 2016. Initially, the closing date for submission of the comments was December of 2016, but that date was extended until the end of January 2017. And I want to highlight the fact that this is participatory democracy in action. We received about 75,000, nearly 76,000 comments on the book. Okay, lots of those comments were in the form of petitions, but that's the extent to which the public rose to the occasion and gave comments, and we would like to think that lots of those comments were taken into consideration in preparing the bill that you have before for us. I could perhaps just conclude by referring to an article that we saw recently. The Prevention and Combating of Hate Crimes and Hate Speech Bill has recently been tabled in Parliament. It is an improved version of its 2016 predecessor, which was then in draft form. In an open and democratic society, the freedom to express ideas is important, but that freedom has to be underpinned by considerations of other values, including dignity, quality, and freedom. It is this delicate balance which the bill, by and large, successfully achieved. That was written by an NGO. So we have taken to heart what has been said in the comments, and the bill, I would like to think, represents or constitutes something that South Africans are happier with than they were with the 2016 version. Thank you. Just maybe to wrap up or summarize some points. The hate crimes bill particularly has been requested by a number of organizations in civil society which had formed a hate crimes working group, and it was in response to what they perceived as hate crimes. So the object of the hate crime section is an existing crime, as you would see from clause 3, that is motivated because of the accused suspect, whatever's prejudice or intolerance towards the victim because of a number of characteristics. So the issue was how to elevate. So for example, the murder of somebody because of their race, their religion, their gender orientation in the case is murder's already a serious crime. Also the rape of a person, the rape of a lesbian because of her gender orientation, rape's already serious. So it was a little bit of a difficulty in terms of how to elevate. Obviously on the lower level, throwing a brick at a mosque may be just malicious injury to property. Which is minor. If you can then prove that the motive was because the person didn't like Muslims, then it becomes a hate crime, and that would be more elevated. But the issue of starting it in the regional court, not the district, was to also show that elevation. The requirement for the Director of Public Prosecutions to make a decision around prosecution is there to try and ensure that at least you've got a higher level of prosecutor who's deciding on whether to go ahead with a matter or not. You'll see the list. The one that might raise eyebrows, this is now on the hate crimes issue, is occupational trade. That, though, is there because, I would imagine that killing somebody because, or attacking somebody because they belong to Uber, and they're not a meat taxi, then might, in that context, be a hate crime. So that does happen. The intention was also to include attacks on sex workers on the basis that they are sex workers. The issue in the difference between the two lists on hate crime and hate speech is you will find occupational trade is not there, as political affiliation or conviction is also not there under the hate speech list. And that was basically not to curtail, not to involve during election campaigns. I mean, if you attack somebody because they're ANC or because they're IFP, that would be a hate crime, or if they're assaulted because of that. However, in terms of hate speech, it's been omitted because of the danger of it probably being used to curtail political debate. Similarly, occupational trade is not there under the hate speech list. There were points being raised that politicians wanted to protect themselves from criticism and to get rid of any perceptions in that regard. The hate speech section was added at a more later point, and that was really in response to particularly all the racist incidents. The current law, as I understand it, is that
a violation of the Equality Clause can then result in a matter being taken to an equality court in terms of FAPUDA. And that can result in the person responsible being fined or subject to some kind of penalty. FAPUDA is, however, a civil court, so it's not criminal. The onus is on somebody to bring the case against the perpetrator. So the idea was that hate speech needed to be criminalized. Currently, the law that is used at the moment is crimen injuria, which is an old, as you'd know, Roman Dutch common law crime. There are some areas that are not clear. Some people say, for example, that for crimen injuria, you need to be impairing, and if crimen injuria is basically about impairing the dignity of a person, that you need to impair the dignity of a specific person rather than a general, a group of people. So the feeling as well was, look, we needed our own statutory law relating to hate speech. And then, as has been said, the subclause 2 has come in. I myself engaged with numerous groupings all over the country of religious leaders or representatives of religious organizations. And the idea is basically not to, the religious texts can be controversial. I think the main concern was one over issues of what does specifically the Bible say about homosexuality. And the idea is not to criminalize any religious text, the Bible or anything else. So my understanding of the wording currently is that you can preach what you want to, but you can't incite violence, harm against people. So the example I use on that is that the Grace Bible Church incident would not be hate speech. However, the Stephen Anderson, that American preacher, would be, because he was advocating attacks and death to homosexuals. So just that. The issue of the penalties, as Mr. Bassett had said, there was a debate around and it's also linked to the seriousness issue. If you're saying that hate crimes, hate speech and hate crimes are serious, then if you say the matter can be diverted or you encourage diversion by putting it in the Act, are you then actually saying it's not so serious? But as he'd said, can be brought up, but it's not specifically provided for in the Act. That's something that there may be debates over. So I just wanted to add those points, Chairperson.
Deputy Minister and officials, I just want to make the following opening remarks, that the central problem which I want to characterize as the national question in this country is that of racism. And when I read the Constitution, I will understand it to say we want to create the strategic objective is to create a non-racial, non-sexist and democratic South Africa. Are we saying that criminalization of racism is something that must be postponed and that for now we should just deal with intolerance or prejudices, which are already dealt with in various statute books? If not, at what point are we going to deal with the central issue of racism, which lies at the heart of the problems that centuries were spent in the struggles by our people? But secondly, South Africa means all the people in South Africa, and more than 80% of the people are traditional communities. Now, if we say that only directors or public prosecutors can initiate the proceedings, are we not elevating the offenses to modern courts to the exclusion of traditional and community courts, which are also, in terms of the law, part of the legal system? Would that not exclude the majority of the people who, as matters stand now, don't even have access to the modern courts? And if you take matters to the regional courts, that also presupposes the use of legal representation. And you know, legal representation is expensive. And we're also a multicultural society, interfaith, interreligious society. Are we not trying to criminalize moral issues without taking society along with us? Wouldn't it have been useful, really, to have a national dialogue on these issues before we criminalize them? Are we not running ahead of the people and therefore create more problems? Are we not going to end up with more people in already overcrowded prisons because of intolerances and so on? And if you say you had thousands of submissions, would it not have been helpful that a report, a summary of those submissions is made, circulated, so that we gain insights into what society is saying about this? Also, you know, there's a case of Mombek about the use of the K word. You know, some of us who tend to read history try to trace the origins of the K word. You find that in some religions, for instance, in Islam, that K word simply means a non-believer. Now, if we have not educated the public about these issues, and an innocent member of an Islamic institution in the rural area uses the K word because that person is trying to refer to someone as not believing in his religion, are we going to take such people to court, find them guilty of a criminal offense, and so on? All I'm saying is, are we not actually running ahead of society and risking creating more problems than the problems that we want to solve? I recall that you also had a forum against racism in the department, which has existed for more than 15 years. Wouldn't it have been helpful also that we get a report of what that forum has produced? In short, I'm saying that we are such an inter-religious society, multicultural society, and can we really deal with the challenges of such a complex society by criminalizing all kinds of intolerances in the society without doing that in tandem with the community dialogues, national dialogue, community education? Can you just maybe address us on the desirability of this act, which in my view, firstly, does not address this national question of racism, secondly, which kinds of runs ahead of public education, because we may end up making criminals out of people who are innocent, because although it is said, you know, ignorance of the law is no mistake, but I think that we have a duty to, we have a new dispensation, a human rights dispensation. We have a duty to educate our people on human rights so that when we criminalize activities, we are sure that we are moving, you know, matching and matching with the society. Otherwise, we just fill the prisons, which are already overcrowded. So, in short, what is the desirability of this hate bill, except that some people call for it, but by its nature already, I think it is exclusive of the traditional communities. They wouldn't be able to access this courts. Can we hear Advocate Bassett?
Look, the bill does criminalize racism. So I'm not sure, but it's our constitutional framework is based on the Equality Clause, and that any inequality then has consequences, and that's where Papuda comes in. And Papuda gets used for any kind of abusive language, for example. So whether it is about a person's religion, about a person's sexual orientation, about a person's race, Papuda can be used. But the problem is Papuda is civil, which means you've got to, well, you can use an equality court without legal representation, but it would help you if you've got legal representation. In a criminal court, you don't have legal representation because the state has the duty to prosecute. So the issue of this then makes it more accessible to people to basically lay a charge of a hate crime or hate speech. And then the matter will be prosecuted. It will be the accused who will have to get legal representation to defend themselves. But I chair the, and I think the officials can add, but the bill does criminalize racism. It just criminalizes other harmful utterances relating to other issues in the Equality Clause. Now, the increasing crimes, look, as I said, hate crimes are existing crimes. It's just elevating them. And that is important in a society, and I think globally, a world that is showing greater intolerance. And it's to try and, it won't stamp them out entirely, but it's in trying to put greater penalties to say this is a more serious crime. So you attack somebody, let's take political violence, you attack somebody during a political campaign, it will be assault, grievous bodily harm, etc., right up to murder if they get killed. If you can prove that the reason was because of their political affiliation, it then becomes a hate crime, it becomes more serious, and we would hope that would provide more of a deterrent to that kind of activity. The new crime, as I said, is hate speech. So, as far as hate crimes, I don't see too much of what the issue is. The crime of hate speech, as I said, is new, and that was because we've only got criminalia as a crime, and it's not particularly clear what all the elements are. Definitely the context in which words are used becomes important. So, on a lighter note, the N-word. If I were to use as a white person to use the N-word to somebody, I would be regarded as being racist. If the secretary of the committee were to use it to one of his colleagues, it's part of the lingo. You know, young people, young men particularly, use the word in reference to each other in a non-offensive way. Nigger. It's an American term, but it's an American term for an African American. But it's become, so it was a negative word. But it's become then, I think, well, I don't want to bring the secretary in, but younger people of the same race call each other that. But I can't call it because it's the context. So you're right, Chair, we wouldn't want to be criminalizing any religious text that used the K word. And the context is also important. As you know, there's a case before court at the moment is can a black person who called another black, used the K word, is that racism? Can you be racist if you call another person of that? I mean, the court still has to decide. But yeah, it would be context very much. As far as this isn't criminalizing morality. So for example, so I don't think we're running ahead of people, because it's basically things that in terms of the Constitution are already wrong. And then as far as, look, the I'm not sure the Forum Against Racism that you're referring to, there is a program in terms of the Durban World Conference Against Racism, to draft a national action plan against racism, xenophobia, racial intolerance, and related intolerances. And that is in the process of being finalized. It was put out for comment. And then the report, we can produce the report. Look, you'll be putting it out for public comment anyway, so you will see what responses you get and whether people feel that their concerns were addressed, but they were primarily on the religious question, which we think we've addressed by providing for, amongst other categories, a sort of partial exemption for religious preachings. But I don't know, Chair, if the officials want to add anything.
No, just I don't want to. Honourable Mutab didn't even know what nigger is. You know, before we spoke about African-Americans, black people were called niggers in America. And it was regarded as an insult. But if you go to Africa, you have a country called Nigeria, derived from the word nigger. Nigeria means the land of the black people. And now you have a country called the Sudan. Sudan means the land of the black people. Now, that's why I say that you know, we need to know where we come from, understand things, because we may even be criminalizing things that normally should not be criminalized. You know, the Eastern Cape was called Kafreria, the land of the black people. So that's why I'm saying that education should be very important and so on. And that's why I raised the question of desirability and whether or not we are not running ahead of the people. But the bill is before us for discussion. Let's open the floor for discussion. Honorable Swart, I'll take the names.
No, Chair, thank you. And from our side, we do understand the need to address the increasing racism in our nation. And so broadly from our side, we would support the hate crimes aspect. But obviously we'll be looking very carefully at that. As far as the hate speech is concerned, we have engaged with the minister, and we are grateful for his engagement with the religious sector and the fact that there has been wide consultations, and this is a good example of participatory democracy and the insertion of this exemption. But as the Deputy Minister indicated, it is a partial exemption. And so one would have to establish, first of all, whether it goes far enough. I think the concern is when you look at the existing, and in our view, sufficient crimen injuria, which is directed to an individual. We had the Momberg case where it was shocking, her utterances, and she was found guilty on 4 counts. And the first time a person has been sentenced to jail for her hate speech. So the question is correctly, as you put, do we really need this at all? The hate speech side. And this is what we as a committee will have to delve into. Given the fact that it has, the common law crime has been used effectively. Secondly, the issue of concern to me is the exclusion of restorative justice when it comes to hate speech. That is a premise that I have advocated for many, many years in this committee, and I don't understand why it wouldn't be something that is applicable. One needs to bear in mind that Papuda, and that is a question as well, why have sections 25 and 28 of Papuda have never been proclaimed? Now, those place a duty on the state and private parties to promote equality and to look at racism. That act still has not been proclaimed. To what degree, if we need hate speech, should it not be inserted into the Papuda Equality Act? And bear in mind that in terms of that act, there's a provision that a court can refer it for criminal prosecution. A quality court can refer it for criminal prosecution as well. The Equality Act is a restorative process. In the case of Vicky Momberg, she was charged criminally and in terms of the Equality Act. So I have a concern still, and I need to study this in greater detail as to whether the hate speech side is at all necessary. I'm concerned at the fact of how one will, the impact it will have on freedom of journalism, freedom of expression, freedom of religious expression. And the Deputy Minister will be aware of the concerns that were raised when he met with the religious sector, and their concerns that there are certain activists that are using existing provisions, and that this might be used further And maybe, Deputy Minister, you remember the concerns that were issued by the Church of certain agendas that were being pursued. Whether this exemption is sufficient, we need to look at that. But immediately I can ask the question, why in sub 2 do you have in good faith, and then you say again, any bona fide? You've got a double barreled, in good faith, 2, and then A, any bona fide. Now, any bona fide, going to section 16, you're lifting the bar, the constitutional bar is being lifted in terms of this act, it's higher. There's no bona fide requirement in section 16, the freedom of expression. That is a concern to us. I'm also concerned, why shouldn't district courts deal with this issue? Why shouldn't traditional courts, as the chairman indicated? Our regional courts and high courts are, and I'm talking particularly now when it comes to hate speech. I don't see any justification. I can understand with hate crimes. But why shouldn't district courts, if you're going to go this route, deal with that? They are already, your regional courts and high courts are so full that that is a concern to me. You see, if the ambit is to protect groups of people and not individuals, then one's got to look carefully at your definition of harm, which includes emotional, psychological, economic harm. Those definitions, to me, are too broad. If you're looking at a specific individual, like in the Vicky Momberg case, there was a clear victim there that clearly suffered harm that justified a criminalisation. And so, Chair, these are some of the issues we need to look into. I would look forward to a lengthy time of public submissions, given the fact that you say there were 70 to 80,000 public submissions. I'd like to report on that, but just to what degree, as we look into this, to what degree it is sufficient, the exemptions that have now been inserted. Chair, the issue of, you see, we need to understand whether this act, to what degree, Mr. Bassett, is this lining up with the Equality Act and the Forms and Publications Act and the Draft Cyber Crimes Act. We pass in so many different acts, we need to ensure whether, firstly, they are aligned, and secondly, whether we need the hate speech side of this, given the fact that it is very clearly set out in terms of the Equality Act, given that the Equality Act allows a referral to the criminal courts as well, and then given the fact that you've got criminal in your as well. So I just, at this stage, again, we've got the National Action Plan to Combat Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerances. That is to be filed at the end of this year. To what degree does this fit into that process? And so, Chair, these are some of the issues, but I do want to just thank the Deputy Minister and the Department for their engagement up to now. It's been very constructive, and I'm sure going forward we will be able to ascertain whether we need the hate speech side of the aspect is needed at all. Thank you, Chair.
There was almost a civil war in the center of Johannesburg because of the cartoons relating to the former president, where some people said, some journalists said, it was their right, freedom of expression, and some people said this is against our culture. And now I see also under exceptions that some artistic creativity is excluded. So with regard to the desirability issue that Honorable Sort is raising, if we can also deal with the desirability of these exclusions, as we say, our society is very multicultural, multi-ethnic, and we shouldn't do things piecemeal. Any other honorable Honorable Breitenbach, Honorable Mutapo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very large in the thing that I'm worth, is it worth it? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm largely covered by the Honourable Swart and his comprehensive input. I'm concerned about the bona fide requirement, as you mentioned, that that's an issue. I'd like to be sure that we're going to take public participation in the committee, because I would look forward to that, and I'd like to know from Mr. Bassett some summary of the public input that you've got. If we could perhaps have sight of that, I'd be very interested to see what they were. I mean, I don't want to talk to all 75,000, but if you've got some sort of summary of them, that could be very helpful. And then, we'd have to, as Mr. Oswald said, we'd have to consider very seriously the overlap with other legislation and the common law. We're passing a lot of legislation, and it makes it very difficult for people to have to prosecute that when there are 5 or 6 or 7 different pieces of legislation being the same thing. Just all that, what we're aware of. So we just need to bear that in mind. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Honorable Chairperson, colleagues, Deputy Minister, Baton and Chief, Media. Thank you so much for the presentation and for the summary of this very important bill. What I would like to know, Chairperson, is since 2001, as Honorable Swart has alluded to and the Chairperson, there has been key strategic guidelines, strategies and plans. You know them, the Urban Declaration and Program of Action, 2003 is National Forum Against Racism, 2009 is National Policy Guidelines for Victim Empowerment, and then the National Development Plan, fine. Then we have the National Strategy for Developing an Inclusive and Cohesive South African Society. And then again, there was a research by South African Human Rights Commission, which I requested the Secretary to submit to members, which I think will be very much important in when we engage with this bill. What I would like to know is whether Advocate Basson did take into consideration all these key strategic guidelines into consideration when you were busy with this bill, because it appears they are very, very, very important to in the finalization of the bill. And again, on the issue of PEMPUDA, Honorable Swart did make mention of sections 25 to 28, which up to now are not yet implemented. And again, there is a section 10 which has been declared unconstitutional of the same PEMPUDA. And I'm happy today, at least some of us are aware that PEMPUDA deals mostly with civil inequality costs, and this will deal differently with criminal cases. So what I would like to know is, because we have been informed that PEMPUDA was supposed to be amended, but up to 2017, we haven't received anything. Then the size is somehow aligned to what Honorable Swart have just said. So the impact it will have on this bill, if those amendments will be made later, and the Section 10, which has been declared unconstitutional. And again, the issue of draft national action plan, which is to be submitted to cabinet by end December this year. The impact also thereof. And the issue of traditional issue relating to our tradition and custom. Now, where that section 30 and 31 of the Constitution does recognize traditional, cultural, linguistic communities. And therefore, I would like to know, because there are other, because we have here, this bill is creating hate speech, isn't it? Therefore, I would like to know, in terms of our, there's some way in this documentation I've seen where you relate to religious belief and so forth. So I'd like to know, there are other things. Deputy Minister John Jeffries made mention of an example of throwing a young boy throwing or girl throwing a stone at a mosque because the intention not known. So I would like to know, in terms of the religion or belief, there are people who hate some of the traditional practices, isn't it? So will the same be said of that, of a person who will be behaving in a similar manner as the one, the example which the Honorable Deputy Minister has referred to? Let me take an example of initiation school. Initiation school, then a church not being far from that. So the initiation school being practiced, singing. So the church people becoming infuriated. Go and burn that initiation school. Will that also fall within that category of that? And some terminologies, like we said, we used to say in rural areas, even in Khoza, if you are not circumcised, you are called Ingwengwe, isn't it? The Shuburu in our culture. So, somebody will take you up in terms of that. So also, please, clarify me on that. And again, on issue of exemptions, I didn't get it clearly, Deputy Minister, exemptions, if it can be explained thoroughly to me. And also there is on the issue of prevalence, I think the Honorable Chair and Honorable Swart touched it very clearly, and the Vicky Momberg case and other cases which the parliamentary staff did mention here, a lot of them. So I think this bill, Honorable Members, is long overdue. It's long overdue. Has been overtaken by events. That's why when Ms. Momberg was found guilty of this crimen injuria and jailed, everybody was puzzled. Hey, is it so serious? Because people undermine this the crimen injuria part of it. That's why I say this long overdue. Thank you, Chairman.
You know, there's a publication called The Rapus, which is written by learned lawyers. Learned lawyers who are supposed to represent us in the courts. It raises the question that Honorable Mutabo raises. Is cultural male circumcision compatible with international children's rights? When lawyers who are supposed to represent us in courts still ask this type of questions, and where are we going? Doesn't it mean that we are even running ahead of the lawyers, that we have to rely on to defend us?
Can I just say on that one? I mean, I agree with you. It's pretty. I haven't read the article. The LSSA rep didn't give me a copy. But I mean, you know, they complain about cultural circumcision. But what about religious, which is of young newborn babies, which the Muslims and the Jews do?
We'll give you more time, Honorable Deputy Minister, because I think this raises an important national debate, and I think South Africans will be happy that you tabled such a bill so that we really can deal with matters that are at the heart of our facing our society. Honorable Skosan, follow up. Oh, maybe with can we allow Honorable Buthelezi to speak first?
Thank you, Chair. I didn't have much to say because what I wanted to say was covered by my previous colleagues. So I wouldn't have anything for now.
Yeah, no, thanks, Honorable Chair, and greetings to Honorable Members, the Honorable Deputy Minister, and the House at large. Yes, if indeed we were dealing with a very complex matter here, which is not easy. Well, I want to know which and matter that you raised earlier, Honorable Chair, on the issue of the regional courts, the accessibility of regional courts to our various communities, because ordinarily courts that are closer to our communities are the magisterial district courts, the traditional courts also. So I'm just wondering as to how our people are going to be able to access the regional courts in terms of this matter. But secondly, the issue of step-by-step of reporting the cases on hate speech. What would be the first step that a person must then take to report such a case, if it have to be taken to a regional court for prosecution? Now, the third question I see on the issue of the exemption that says on clause 4.2d excludes from the ambit of hate speech any bona fide interpretation and proselytizing or espousing of any religious tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine, or writing. And I've heard one of my colleagues, Honorable Swart, indicating that from their side they are happy with thorough consultations, I think, of the department with various religious leaders on this. Because when I look at it, I think religious or a religion is in its nature. One religion opposes the other one. So when a preacher, when a Christian preaches, in most of the cases, he or she will offend a person maybe who believes in a traditional religion. Because he would say, in Christianity, you don't have to do this. If you are doing this, you are doing that. And that he, what he or she will be referring to is what other people's belief is. See, so I'm just looking at these things of exemption to say, because you are, the understanding is that you are preaching, this is Christianity, this is Muslim, this is Hindu, this is African traditional religion, so there's that exemption. But now what about the rights of those whom, while you are preaching your own religion, you then, I think in a way, taking down the dignity of the other religion. I'm just checking on that as to how we're going to then pass there. And then also on the issue of artistic creativity, I see, I think on the same page, which is page 6, which speaks about clause 4, it says artistic creativity or performance or espousal of religious doctrine will not qualify for exemption from hate speech if it advocates hatred that constitute incitement to cause harm based on any protected grounds. Well, I've underlined the if it advocates. But on the artistic creativity, because for instance, we look at the issue of comedians. Most comedians, well, normally when they put their jokes, it would in a way offend somebody. Their jokes will be on race, it will be on ethnicity, it will be on various religions, it will be on sexual orientation. So if here we say artistic creativity or performance will not qualify for exemption from hate speech, I don't know as to what extent does it affect those who are practicing or who are in that field of artistic creativity. Because, yeah, I mean, in the main, especially comedians, I mean, generally what they are saying in the name of comedy, but it will, other people might not feel comfortable. Well, others would accept that, no, but this is just a comedy. It's not intended to degrade a certain race, degrade a certain ethnic group, or degrade people of a certain sexual orientation, etc., or cultural practice. So I'm just looking at it just to see how are we going to manage that moving forward. The next point, Honorable Chair, the issue of elevation in terms of the hate crime. I've heard the Deputy Minister indicating that if a person has committed a certain crime, maybe there's an assault, and therefore maybe there's a suspicion that this assault is not just only assault, but this assault, it has to do with race, or it has to do with ethnicity, it has to do with sexual orientation, it has to do with other things other than in it being an assault only. So that kind of a crime must be then elevated. So at what stage do we elevate? Because a person would go to a police station report and say this, there's an assault case, and then obviously go to the magisterial court. Then at what point do we then say, no, this has to be elevated to a regional court because it's not only an assault, but there's an hate crime part of it. When do we do that? Do we do that when it's at the magisterial court, district court, or whenever there's a suspicion, maybe at the SAPS after the case has been reported, when there's a suspicion, it will then be elevated. Because I see it's going to be, in my view, it's a very complex thing. Because when you look at the list, in terms of the hate crime, I mean, in terms of the hate speech and stuff, list of the things that we have mentioned, it will only be on the basis of suspicion. It means every time when people of two races have assaulted each other, even if there's nothing to do with the race, but there will always be a suspicion that, no, this is it's race related. Or even people of two different ethnic groups, just because they belong to two different ethnic groups, means we have to check as to whether is it not on the basis of ethnicity. If one is disabled, is it not on the basis of the disability? If one is of a different sexual orientation, is it not on the basis of that? It looks more complex in dealing with that. So at what stage do you then say, no, this one will have to elevate it? The last point, which I think my colleagues also spoke about it, the issue of overlapping with other legislations. How do we manage that? Thanks, Honorable Chair.
I think lawyers will have enough business to deal with these overlappings, but unfortunately, I doubt if our lawyers are well equipped to deal with these complexities, because our universities don't teach about our cultures, don't teach about these religions. Now, if Honorable Skosana, you are right to say this is more complex. Where are we going to get lawyers who are educated enough to deal with these issues? But also there's this issue of the many documents that went before, whether or not these documents have been taken into account. And also the South African Human Rights Commission reports to the United Nations. We haven't seen the reports that they sent to the United Nations on these matters. What are they saying on these matters? And then I think all these reports could have helped throw some light on the desirability or otherwise of the hate bill. I think that should be the central issue that we're dealing with. Is this matter desirable at this stage? Are these matters not being dealt with under the existing law.
Yeah, if I can start, please allow the officials opportunity to add. Let me start again with the desirability issue. I mean, this bill has come from Cabinet, and it so it's the view of Cabinet that it's desirable. I noticed that Honourable Motapo says it's long overdue. Others, you are saying you don't seem to think it's so desirable. But the yes, I can assure you, it takes into account all other documents. So, for example, this is you would see when the National Action Plan comes out that one of the aspects is the criminalization of racism, related intolerances, xenophobia, that kind of thing. And as far as the other, so it's part of that. It's not being seen as the panacea to discrimination. It's just simply criminalizing discrimination. And then the other laws, I mean, you'll see, I mean, the issue of the cybercrime, there's no conflict. Ms. Pillay can speak about the Papuda amendments, but, you know, well, firstly, just on that, Honourable Motapo, you said that Section 10 has been ruled as unconstitutional. I'm not aware of that. That's the section in Papuda that refers to hate speech. And it basically, but the problem is there's no, although Papuda refers to hate speech, there's no definition in our law of hate speech. Yes, we've got crimen injuria, but Honourable Swart, does crimen injuria apply to a group? That's one issue. Should we not be saying in this context where there is a lot of intolerance in the country that we need this parliament to define what the rules are, not rely on the courts to build the common law depending on the various people. You will remember, Chair, I think it was a few weeks ago or last week, that I think, if correct me if I'm wrong, but a magistrate said it was worse for a white person to use the K word against another white person. I mean, rather bizarre. That it was worse for a white person to be called a K than for a black person. Now, rather bizarre logic that. We don't want to leave it up to the courts to define what is a crime or what isn't.
That white man is a believer, and in that sense, it means that the other white person is not a believer.
Islam did not feature.
There are white people who are Islam.
It did not feature in this. But on the steps taken, it's a crime. You report it to the police station. You report it to the police. And the police would have to be trained in terms of looking at motive. It would be for the state to prove motive. Okay, so, and motives sometimes would be difficult, but the state would have to prove it. I mean, if you look at the Ashton Willemse incident, you know, was it racist, wasn't it? Whereas what he said at the time very much was that his perceptions were that he was being racially discriminated against. But it would be basically the, so as far as access to courts, it would be access to the police station. You go to the police station to report the matter. It then gets investigated, and the prosecutors decide what happens to the case. The provisions under sub 2 come from the Constitution, basically. If you look at the freedom of expression clause, you know, it starts with everyone has the right to freedom of expression, which includes freedom of the press and other media, freedom to receive or impart information or ideas, freedom of artistic creativity, and academic freedom and freedom of scientific research. But this right does not extend to propaganda for war, incitement of imminent violence, or an advocacy of hatred that's based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. You will see what we've done is we've added more things to that list. The argument has been used with regard to Papuda that, you know, simply being racially abusive is not, if for Papuda to penalize racially abusive words, expressions, is unconstitutional, racially or other. So in the Khoelane case, I think Mr. Khoelane argued that Papuda, he had just said not so nice things about gay people. The court found against him. He argued it was unconstitutional for Papuda to say he should be penalized for that. And the court found against him. He's appealing, so that issue has to be settled. I see Honourable Breitenbach has left, but Honourable Horn's colleague, Ms. Diane Kohler-Barnard, she is before the Equality Court. She is taking the issue, raising a constitutional issue, that all three factors listed here must be raised. So she's raising a constitutional challenge as well to Papuda. Generally, though, you would find in the rulings of the Constitutional Court, the SARS case where the K word was used against a person, the CJ wrote the judgment, and it was quite explicit that this word was not was very derogatory, and a few other cases as well. But that's where the exemptions come in. So, Mr. Swart, even with the religious exemption, I would say in terms of the Constitution, you cannot advocate in preaching. You can't advocate hatred based on, let's say, race, and that constitutes incitement to cause harm. The Constitution's explicit on that. And the same would apply to the others. But basically, you can say not so nice things about other people or other groups in church, in an artistic display. I mean, we had one Equality Court matter, Chair, from Cape Town, where there was a display in the gallery here. I suppose I should watch my words, but a display with a symbol F, what's it, little star, F star CK, white people. Okay, and somebody took that to the Equality Court, which actually ruled that it wasn't hate speech because it was an artistic display and the context. Context is important. But we've got, I mean, there's a lot of borderline cases that would need to be looked at. That's hence also the reason for the elevation. But, the comedians can say terrible things about people of a different religion, but as long as they're not inciting, that it's not advocating hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm. And again, with religious preachings, the same issue. You can say, look, this other religion or this other sect within the religion is bad, they're not good people, they may be going to hell, but you can't advocate attacks on them. That's really the borderline, as I would see it.
Honourable, I'm sorry, I record you, but you may allow you to speak here.
Fine, except by style.
Okay.
So, just basically that. Look, I think the committee should be looking at whether, the elevation issue, should there be restorative, Mr. Swart, I think it's a valid point. Should specifically on hate speech, should there be an effort to look at restorative justice? As I said, the original thing with both hate speech and hate crimes was, are we not then undermining what it is? Shouldn't the district courts deal with it? Part of the concern was the sort of complexity of the issue from both the prosecution and the presiding officer's part, that you'd want more experienced people to be involved. But let me leave it like that. But if I can then hand over to Ms. Pillay and Mr. Bassett or anyone else.
Thank you,
Deputy Minister.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members, for the questions and the comments that were made in relation to the bill. I just also want to speak to the issue of the desirability of the bill and to deal with the issues of concerns over overlapping legislation. It's correct that we do have the Papuda, and there are sections that have not been put into operation insofar as the promotion of equality is concerned. It has taken many years. And I just want to say that what we are doing in that regard is those sections require an amendment to make it implementable, which is something that we are working on, and we intend to publish a bill for comment in that regard before the end of this year. The other strategy that we are working on and the document that we intend to put out is the National Action Plan, as was mentioned, which also deals with what should we do to improve relations between different groups in our society. But all of that does not address the criminalization of these serious offenses. Over and above having those strategies, it was felt that in view of the nature of the complaints and blatant racist comments that are made, etc., there isn't a specific law that deals with the criminalization of these offenses. It's the issue of elevation which our Deputy Minister has spoken to. But over and above that, it also brings certainty and clarity because if you open a case of criminal injury, for instance, it is considered a common law offense, and it's not considered to be as serious except for the recent example that we've seen in the Momper case. But you will have different public prosecutors who may take different decisions insofar as how they implement the crime of crimen injuria, and some may actually regard it as not so serious. But in creating the offences in this bill, we bring absolute certainty and clarity that if you utter those derogatory terms or you commit any of the offences that we intend to create in the bill, that there is a crime to deal with it. And we do away with that. It's no longer open to interpretation. There's absolute certainty. So I just want to make that clear. But I think also insofar as saying how seriously we regard the offences, the decision that was taken in the way the bill is worded to say that only the High Court may deal with the matters and not the district courts as such is because regional courts and the High Court is firstly because of the seriousness of the offences and in relation to the kind of sentences that can be imposed, but also to say that the DPP must take a decision on whether we prosecute or not. And quite correctly, I think Honourable Member Skosana mentioned the kind of challenges that you will see. For example, if you have a disabled person involved in an assault case, can you automatically say that it's a hate crime? And because you're adding this element of a hate crime, you want it to be proper interpretation and you want it to be consistent decisions taken on how we prosecute them. So I think insofar as what this bill is trying to do, that's where the certainty element comes in. Also with regard to, there were quite a few honourable members that requested the comments that were made during the consultation phase. We do have a document on that, and I think we can make that available. Insofar as the comment that was made about comedians, we do create an exemption insofar as artistic creativity, but only insofar that it does not incite hatred. And I think it does not advocate hatred that constitutes incitement to cause harm based on one or more of the grounds referred to in that subsection that contains all the grounds of discrimination. I think that's what I want to say for now. I don't know whether Mr. Bassett wants to add anything further.
Thank you, Chair. Just one thing I'd like to draw attention to, Section 7, A2, Clause 7A2 of the bill. Yes, how do you elevate and how do you report and how do you go about prosecuting these cases? It depends on the evidence that is in the docket. But Clause 7 requires the NDPP to issue directives regarding all matters which are reasonably necessary or expedient to be provided for and which must be complied with all members by the prosecuting authority, including on the following: the leading of relevant evidence indicating the presence of prejudice or intolerance towards the victim. So, as I indicated in the briefing, there's an emphasis on training, and part of that training is going to be how do you prove motivation,
relating to this prejudice, and the NDVP must make issue directives on that to make it easier for, to give guidance to prosecutors on how to deal with those issues. There was also the issue of bona fide double dipping. We will have a look at that and revert. I think, yeah, I just wanted to...
Maybe just to add, look, the bona fide thing, as I understand it, and this is Mr. Swart raising it, it's raised for artistic comedians, that kind of thing, and religious. And it's basically that you can't just claim to be a religious preacher. You've got to show that you are, as it were. You can't claim, you can't say something nasty and then claim you're an artist. Got to be bona fide, but I think the thing can be looked at, but I think that's where it came from. The other issue that wasn't responded to was Honorable Matapo. Yes, I would say that if there are, I mean, culture and ethnic or social origin are included in both the hate crimes and the hate speech section, so if there are attacks on people because of their cultural practices, that could be, if it can be proved, a hate crime or hate speech. Obviously, if it's coming from a religious body, then it becomes a bit more difficult because it's subject to that religious exemption, and it would have to be advocating hatred that's incitement to cause harm. So if a church is saying that, if a church is saying that people if it's part of the preaching, then simply saying heathens going to hell, backward people, whatever other nasty things you can think of, that would be allowed because it's of the religious exemption. However, if it's not part of the bona fide preaching, it's somebody's expressing their own view, then it could be a hate speech.
If you say that can be allowed,
and 80% of the indigenous people would be offended by that remark. And you say you exempt the person who says it, and when 80% feel offended, don't you think that can even lead to civil war in a country?
Well, look, it's not. Remember, it's specifically from a religion. For everybody else, it would be, you wouldn't be, it would be hate speech. But if it's part of the bona fide proselytizing or espousing of a religious tenet, belief, teaching, doctrine. So if it's part of the sermon, then I would say it becomes more difficult because of that exemption. But if it's not part of the sermon, then it would be hate speech.
If they say, the cultural, they say, hey, you there. Then what will then happen? Because those things are there, are prevalent.
Mm.
Yes.
If it's not part of the
exemption,
if it's not part of the espousing of the religious tenet, so if it's just said, then I would think
no.
It would be, yeah.
Agree, they believe,
yeah.
in that cult, isn't it? They believe they are traditionalists.
Yes.
Yes.
But I'm talking about...
Like praying their ancestors.
Yes.
In terms of Christianity, the taboo, isn't it?
If they have the sermon which says you should not pray to the ancestors, then you've got a problem with the exemption. Okay? And I hear what you're saying, Chair, but if it's not part of the sermon, if it's just an expression, then it could fall into the hate speech category.
You know, in the center of Johannesburg, already bishops, Christian bishops, are intolerant of the Muslim. When the Muslims call for prayer, there's this minaret. When those bells ring to call for prayer,
some Christian bishops feel offended, and as a result they say some nasty things. Now the question is, it will be Christians against Muslims, each one of them relying on their religious text. It will be 8% of the Africans relying on their cultural practices. The question is, where are we going to get the lawyers educated enough to draw these fine distinctions in this complex situation?
But Chair, just a quick response to that. It would be, that's why it's the Director of Public Prosecutions who must decide on prosecuting, not your ordinary senior public prosecutors, and also why Mr. Bassett referred you to that section of the NDPP having to come up with guidelines.
No, Chair, I think the examples are illustrating the difficulties with hate speech, the broadness. Because we're talking about, if you have individuals, then it is far easier. If you've got groups, as you correctly say, there are Christians that might say something that might offend other faiths or traditional, but it works the other way as well. That you might have Muslims saying something against the Jewish faith, or Muslims saying something against... So this is the challenge, where you've got groups involved. Where you've got individuals, it's far easier to determine this. And Deputy Minister, I'm concerned when you speak about limiting the religious exemption to preaching, because here it speaks about proselytizing. Proselytizing is a traditional religious person that speaks to a Christian and says, you must come back to a traditional religion. Or a Christian saying to a Muslim, convert. Now so it's not limited. It can't be limited. But if you're saying it's limited, then it's a massive concern. But it can't be, because you said preaching only. Many faiths go out and walk, the Jehovah's Witnesses goes door to door to door. And that could be very offensive to other people. So this is what it illustrates, the challenge, and you've correctly tried to address the challenges, but whether you've done it sufficiently will be for this committee to decide whether we open up a hornet's nest with hate speech or not, or whether we deal with hate crimes. I think that is the biggest ambit. But I just wanted to ask on the bona fide, you see, you haven't addressed the issue of raising the bar above what the Constitution requires. Double dipping is the first issue. But the bona fide artistic creativity is not in the Constitution. There's no such thing as that. But can I ask, the test, is the test for harm subjective or objective? To me, that is my concern, is that it appears to be subjective from the view of the group or the individual, and that is the challenge. That's the last, and the last issue is what the chairperson said about the overcrowding of our high courts and our regional courts. They're not dealing with it now. We've just done the budget. You know the overcrowding. Now to elevate, I can't see it ever justifiable to elevate hate speech to regional court and to the high courts that are so overcrowded at the moment. So these are issues which we will unpack, but I want to emphasize our gratefulness that you are seriously and you have been engaging with the various communities and their concerns. And I think, Chairperson, this requires a broad engagement of all the different sectors, which I think will be helpful as we go forward. Thank you, Chair.
There's a follow-up by Honourable Mutapo, and then let's welcome the Minister and allow him...
Minister, I'm sorry, I didn't acknowledge you as well.
Going out to evangelizing, recruiting people to our own religion.
Okay. Minister, Deputy Minister, that issue of Bassett. the issue of, I ask the question relating to belief. The belief, is it also inclusive of traditionalists? Yes. Because
somewhere in the early,
speaking to the mic.
There was this issue in Limpopo where there is an association now in terms of Traditional Healers Practice Act. They are now mobilized under Dr. Gian of Kukuneland. I was telling our secretary to involve them in the whole thing. they approached us, a firm of attorneys in Bulugwane, Mangwe Magabane, because the South African Council of Churches, where most of these churches belong, Christian churches belong, are members, were holding a sermon somewhere saying, please stop praying, honoring ancestors, because in terms of the language, they say, "Kima demoni," when they are demons. So they approach us to say, "No, man, we are not happy." Very angry, very, very angry. The religious people are saying, "Our ancestors, whom we honor, we be as traditionalists, we believe in ancestors. They are saying our ancestors are demons. Please deal with these people." So we organized a meeting between the South African Council of Churches and traditional health practitioners, I mean healers practitioners, to try to mediate. And they were very, very, very angry. So I don't, if this bill is intending to address such things, I'll be very, very much happy. And unfortunately, before the minister came, there was no response in that regard to in relation to traditionalists. That's why I wanted that term which was used. Or does it also include what I'm referring to? Because I understand you consulted on with religious leaders, but they were somehow excluded, and they are mobilized. I remember I even told our secretary to involve the chairpersonship, Dr. Gianni, in that regard. Thank you.
And they are especially
important. Also, the Minister of Health.
Minister wanted to say a few words, and then I also responded to the
Honourable Minister.
Now, thanks, Chair, and apologies for coming late into the debate. In any case, the entire legislative program of the department has been delegated to the Deputy Minister, as you may well be aware, and therefore I've played a minimal role in most of the legislative processes. I may just indicate that when the bill initially confined itself, and it's in a sense in response to the proposition that the hate speech component be dropped. I'm not sure whether that was a firm proposal, but if that be so, I would want to respond in this way, that when the bill initially was put together, at some point, the issue of hate speech in particular was dropped. We had a very long engagement between myself and the Deputy Minister to say that it would be most unfortunate if in the face of resurgence of hate speech to the extent that even the courts have come to the party, as we all are aware, and actually taken the lead by not only giving civil relief, by going further and granting criminal recourse to those who feel that they have been the victim of racial assault, as I would put it, and other forms of prejudice. We will once again find ourselves as a parliament opening ourselves to criticism that here we are again failing society by not taking the bold step of ensuring that as the parliament of the people we lead in giving full effect to the objects of the constitution. You'd recall the criticism that we had in the Nkandla matter I think, and in other matters, I think that this parliament should be bold in executing its constitutional mandate and lead society. That's why we're here, as a general rule. Now, coming to the specific issue, let me also indicate that it would be unfortunate that when the matter is already settled at common law, which dates back 2,000 years ago, long before issues of racism in the manner that they present themselves in our context, for example, that is underpinned by a legacy of colonialism, etc., had already given relief, recourse, with regard to abuse of speech that is offensive enough as to cause harm, we come in 2018 and say, this is a matter that we're going to defer. Defer till when? When Rome is burning. So I really think that we'll be failing society, in my opinion, if we fail to seize the moment and actually assist the courts in further strengthening our tools or their tools to be able to deal effectively with the scourge of not only racism, but other forms of social prejudice. So that would be my starting point, really. But getting into the specifics, I mean, again, if the common law has been able to delineate between that which is offensive enough to attract some form of penalty, civil or criminal, surely we should equally be in a position with all the jurisprudence that has evolved over the years that has offered some or should offer some guidance as to where the line could be, armed further with the clause in the Constitution, we should be able to, I mean, in responding, for example, to the question about religious assault, I mean, I do not see difficulty here. And maybe it's because I'm too blind to see. Because when I was still at university studying law, I used to have a pastime reading different things. And I took time at some point to read about the history of Christianity in the Roman Empire. When persecutions occurred. And my limited understanding of the literature that I was able to go through pointed to the fact that the Christian religion was intolerant of other religions to a point where the Roman Empire felt that it was becoming a threat to the integrity of the empire. And that's what gave birth to all this persecutions and the martyrdom, etc. And my understanding is that the Christians were conscious that they, in fact, were intruding into the faiths of others and by seeking to impose their own faith over those of others by calling them paganism and everything else, and calling on everybody else to subscribe to no other religion except the Christian religion. So it became a political issue. And I think that those are some of the historical experiences that society has gone through to arrive at a conclusion that says, for the sake of harmony in the world, actually, religious tolerance must be the order of the day, so that no religion should seek to undermine, to castigate any other. Right? So I don't think that anybody has a right in our constitution for that matter. And in response to Memutapo's point, to go out there and actively castigate and indulge in provocative, utterances and conduct that would disturb the peace in society. So personally, I don't see a difference. And I think the Christian religion itself, and that may well be true of all other religions, have come to terms with the reality that the only way that human society can live at peace with itself is to acknowledge the right for coexistence of different cultures, different religions, different linguistic groups, etc. And that is what I believe underpins the kind of constitutional order that we have adopted, and whatever these laws are about, seek to reinforce that. And for me, that is the point of departure. But I may be losing...
Thank you, Honorable Minister, for throwing some light on this. I'm just wondering whether, having received this briefing as a committee, we shouldn't sit and on our own deliberate on the issues that arise, and also seek our own legal advisors from Parliament before we take this matter forward. And it's a pity that the Honorable Minister was not here when we started, when contradictions were pointed out and other laws which were not yet put into operation, and other sections which were declared unconstitutional. And now the Honorable Deputy Minister said he was not aware of that, that it would seem that, and most of us hear some of these things for the first time, and then we might need time to internalize and go through this. For one thing sure, some of us believe in an ancestors. I even give liquor to a bull as part of that ancestral practice, and some people say, no, this is pagan, they still continue to do so. So what came out was that our society is very complex, so we should take society along, and otherwise we may end up jailing more than 60% of the population, and correctional centers are already full. But there's also a view that this initiative is very important because there's an increasing intolerance in society, and that really means that we have to do justice to what is before us. So can I hear from the members, do we need time to sit and go through this thoroughly debate? But what Honorable Mutapo also made, she listed a number of documents which should have been informed this discourse, whether we should also not ask the department to favor us with all those documents and reports, so that when we meet to talk, we have gone through those documents. Honorable Zwart.
No, Chair, thank you. Chair, just at the beginning, it's a pity the Minister wasn't here when we engaged earlier. And I appreciate, from our side as the ACDP, we stand for religious freedom. And I think that's the tenet of our Constitution. But I think, Minister, you need to be careful when you say that the religion of Christianity is intolerant in a historical perspective. So one could say that about the Muslim faith. One could say that about other faiths. So I think, although you placed it in a historical perspective, I think we need to be sensitive to how we express ourselves. I find that maybe not justifiable.
But let me immediately apologize, Chair. I'm a Christian myself, and it is You put it in the historical context.
It was in the context of a specific reading that I did with a specific religion at a particular context. It was not aimed in any way to suggest that the Christian religion is intolerant, even in that context. It was how the Romans, as I understood it, felt it and reacted to it.
I think, if anything, the Romans were intolerant. But anyway,
well, I'm just saying, let's not elevate it beyond what
it was purely an response to Ms. McTarpa's question. But Che, can we deal with your issue? I agree with you, Che. We'll close that, and we will engage with that outside. But Che, I am 100% in support of your suggestion. I think we, as a committee, should sit. We've heard what the Minister and the Deputy Minister have said. From our side as ACDP, we are appreciative, Deputy Minister and Department, of the extent that you've tried to engage. But I think Ms. Matapa might be concerned that we haven't engaged more broadly. And I think, Chair, so I am fully supportive of us discussing the issue. Again, I want to emphasize that we are broadly in support of the hate crimes issue. But we have some issues with the hate speech issue. But let's engage as a committee, and we'll take it further. I would second your motion, Chair. Thank you.
Let's hear the honourable member so that when you answer.
Well, it was just, Chair, is this before putting
it out for comment? Is this before putting it out for comment?
No, because if honourable members still have lots of questions and they are not at one, and we go to the public on something that we ourselves are not at one, we may even create more confusion out there. So I think it's important that as the committee we need to understand, have a common understanding of where we are. What is it that we're taking?
Because, Chair, my concern is, the usual practice with bills once they're introduced is that they are put out for public comment. Obviously, there may be different views in the committee on a bill. It has been said by members that there needs to be a lot of space for public comment on this bill. So my concern is, if you're going to first discuss issues with the bill and then put it out for comment, the likelihood of this bill being passed before Parliament rises at the end of the term is not so good. What I can assure you is that, because you raised as part of your motivation the issue of the other legislation and other documents, this is consistent. Okay, this is not over-legislating, it's consistent. The issue that you said of that I was unaware of Section 10, as Memutapo said, being declared unconstitutional, I'm not aware, and is anyone aware? Can I please be referred to the case? Because the implication was that the Crown Court has ruled that section is unconstitutional, and I'm not. I would like to know which case that was in.
The issue of desirability, that as a committee will use a seat and address the desirability, and that if the department favors us with the documents that Honorable Mutapo refers to, that will help us to overcome that.
If you want to, for the first time ever, you want to consider the desirability of a bill before you put it out for public comment.
Chair, I would strongly suggest that sitting here as the committee, fellow member of parliament for that matter, we are not possessed, I would want to submit, of all the wisdom that we will require to guide us even on the question of desirability. I would be more comfortable to a situation where we first allowed ourselves to be influenced by the diverse views out there, which may be mirrored or not even mirrored in the diversity of opinions already expressed around the table here, so as to enrich us to be in a much better position and to even gauge the mood of society generally as another factor that we may take into consideration. Just to illustrate the point, Chair, at some point when I was with social development, we wanted to ban corporal punishment at home in the same manner that we banned it at schools. But it became clear that society was not yet ready for it. So at some point we had to hold back and wait for an opportune time to revisit the matter. So there will always be controversial issues in society which we ourselves sitting on our own may not be possessed of all the wisdom to make a pass judgment as to the state of readiness of society, let alone the correctness or otherwise of whatever position.
Thank you, Honorable
Minister. I thought for today we really were just getting a briefing. And we have received the briefing, and then we have raised issues. And I think all we are saying is that we'll have to meet and decide on the way forward. And then we're honourable on.
I agree with you, Chair. Thanks.
Yeah. So I think we have received the briefing, and then we will sit and then discuss as to how we move forward. Honourable Mutapo.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Okay, in relation to Section 10, for now let me withdraw that statement until I get that information, because it might be misleading. Yeah? Yes, it might be misleading. So Chairperson, on the issue of us discussing this, I think we should also take into consideration some processes which are to be unfolded and the other issues are going on research and a lot of things which may derail us. So I think the sooner we engage in relation to the matter before us, the better, Chairperson. Thank you.
Yeah, Chair. No, Honourable Chair, thanks. We acknowledge the presence of the Honourable Minister. Yeah, what I wanted to say, I concur with you that I think having received the briefing today from the department, I think it will be important that we see it and look at it. But I think what I need to emphasize is that we need to do it urgently. Because I think the concern from the Deputy Minister, it was the issue of time frame. So just to try and speed up the process so that we don't delay, I think, the whole process. Let's just, if we can have put a date and have a date, having received all the other required documents and look at it, just for us, for all of us, just to have clarity. Obviously, it's not us alone who are going to take a decision. It has to, like the Minister indicated, go for public participation process and stuff. But it's just for us to clear our understanding, because I think somewhere, somehow, there are some fine line that differentiate what can be exempted and what can't be exempted. Just those little things. So, but I'm just saying, let's just do it quickly so that we don't delay the process.
I think the documents that, Honorable Mutapo referred listed, and the reports from your engagements, if members of Parliament can have all those, that will help us come up to speed. So how soon can we get the documentation from your side?
Chair, just did you want the documentation, you want a report on the public inputs? That's the one I understand. What else do you want?
I think we would write to you.
Okay. But, Chair, I would urge that you do put out the bill for comment. The bill has been tabled in Parliament. Do the public not have the right to say what they think of the bill? Or are you going to take a decision that you're not going to engage in the bill? As the Minister had said, you would need to be guided by what the public think.
Deputy
Minister, could we just request that you allow the committee to follow its processes as a committee of parliament? I think what I hear is that we will sit as the committee, and then we appreciate the urgency of the matter, and then we will we'll take this bill forward, and we want to take it forward.
Chair, I've never heard of that happening before, that you don't put out a bill for comment.
Honourable members, let me not distract for you. What are you saying?
Chairperson, I propose that we release the department and media, then we remain behind for 30 minutes. No. The international crime deal, ne? Yeah. Okay.
Just to indicate that indeed we defer to the fact that we are the executive and you are the committee of parliament, and there comes a point where we have to respect separation of powers. So you decide how best you manage your work. If you need any support from ourselves, we'd be more than happy to oblige. Thank you,
Minister. And we can say for the record that we see the urgency of the matter in the light of the increasing intolerance. We want to take this matter forward, but we're just saying that as a committee, we just need to sit on our own and clarify certain things, and that should not take long. Thank you very much for helping us. Can we move on to the international?
Yes, Honourable Minister, we are in the
Chair, I am going to leave you in the capable hands of two very capable ladies, Calais, who you're familiar with, who has a legislation and policy space, as well as the acting chief state law advisor, Aisha, to deal with all the aspects relating to this bill. Aisha in particular will be able to navigate you through the journey of this issue that has been characterized by much litigation that you are aware of, both in our domestic and international courts, up to the point where we are today. I'll just make some general opening remarks that South Africa has international policy and international outlook, which has a strong emphasis on the African continent where we belong. And issues of promoting peace and stability as preconditions for the promotion of development objectives of the continent are central to that policy outlook. Our participation in regional and continental bodies such as the AU and the critical role that we play there is also informed by this outlook. Now, this matter has had a direct impact on our ability to prosecute this policy outlook. It came to a head when we as South Africa sought and actually did host a summit of the AU here in Johannesburg, where all constituent members of the AU were invited, in particular their heads of government or heads of state. And as part of preparation for that hosting, and in terms of the Diplomatic Immunities and Privileges Act, I think it's of 2001 or 2002, the Department of International Relations issued a proclamation in terms of which immunity was extended to delegation to that conference. Now, my understanding is at the time Zimbabwe was holding the chair and determined who was to be invited. And among the list of invitees was the President of Sudan, President al-Bashir, who, as you are aware, is the subject of an indictment under the Rome Statute by the ICC. Now, the ICC approached us as a country to seek advice if we so needed in relation to our obligations, in relation to the indictment I've just referred to, prior to the convening of that summit. And in response to that, South Africa dispatched, in the form of the former chief state law advisor, Mr. Enver Daniel, who has since left the chief state law advisor's office, interacting with our mission in The Hague, sought to seek audience with the pretrial chamber to clarify our obligations under the Rome Statute. I'll not go into the details of what happened, but it is apparent from the records that a decision was taken.
What's happening to the members now?
I've just gone to fetch something. I was still correcting. Where are the members? Can you just check outside, because the minister is there to address us. Proceedings.
What transpired was that, of course, and there's all manner of perspectives about what the manner in which proceedings were handled in The Hague that weekend. But there was a decision that said that the consultation processes under the Rome Statute had concluded, and that South Africa was under an obligation to execute a warrant of arrest on President al-Bashir upon his arrival here to attend the AU summit. And of course, on the morning of that Sunday, when the summit occurred, some of us were were rushed to Pretoria at short notice because we're served with papers on an urgent basis to appear within 2 hours to respond to an urgent application calling for the execution of the warrant. I'll not go into much of the detail relating to what transpired at the court. You should by now be familiar with much of it. Safe to say that a decision was taken soon after President al-Bashir had left, that South Africa should have executed the warrant by the North Gauteng High Court, a matter which was appealed against at the SCA. And in the meantime, there was engagement on more than one occasion at the level of the body politic of the ICC in The Hague. I had the privilege of representing South Africa on two occasions, making representations at The Hague to the body politic of the ASP, the body politic of the ICC, and also there was subsequent litigation at the judicial chamber of the ICC that subsequently also released a verdict on whether South Africa was under an obligation to execute the warrant. Briefly to say that as far as my understanding of the subsequent appeal judgment on appeal at the SCA, the court there confirmed the position of the North Gauteng High Court that indeed under our law we were under an obligation to execute the warrant purely because in our own domestication law of the Rome Statute, we have basically tied our hands behind our backs, to paraphrase it, and that it was not the duty of the court to untie us except ourselves, in that what we had put in our own law was not necessarily what we were required to do under the Rome Statute itself. But the Rome Statute never intended to suppress international customary law on diplomatic immunity in the manner that we in our own statute had effected. And that therefore our obligation arose from our own domestic law much more than out of operationalization, in particular of clause 27 of the Rome Statute. We actually decided to accept that judgment. Hence, we chose not to appeal it to the Constitutional Court, even though an attempt was made to drag us there, because we felt that that was a fair assessment of the situation. However, to our surprise, the judicial chamber in The Hague adopted a different approach that effectively said even under the Rome Statute, additional to what we had stated in our own domestic law, we would still have been and were under an obligation to have executed the warrant. As a country, we took a view that says, well, we do not necessarily fully concur with the decision of the court, but we respect it. We opted not to appeal it, partly because we only had 5 days, a grace period that the court gave us, and we were told the 5 days were not 5 court days, but were 5 calendar days. So it wouldn't have provided sufficient time for us to prepare for a proper appeal and other considerations. So we left the matter at that, because in any case, we already had a country decision at a policy level to withdraw from the Rome Statute. And that judgment further justified why we should withdraw. But why did we decide then to withdraw from the Rome Statute? Especially if our own court said that actually the Rome Statute does not prevent the problem that you believe it presents you. Our main difficulty was this. As I indicated, having attempted at least twice, and more recently on the third occasion, we went there to further explain our position to the Assembly of the Parties. Our position was that the Assembly of State Parties created the Rome Statute, has the final responsibility of ensuring that they monitor its implementation, and if there are difficulties in its implementation, they should go back to the drawing board and deal with those issues. In particular, we presented a case that says the judicial chamber itself on several occasions has issued conflicting decisions, which in itself is an indication of confusion about, in particular, whether the Rome Statute for all intents and purposes does away with diplomatic immunity or still recognizes it. And we felt that this was a fundamental question that needed to be resolved so that member states of the ICC are informed beforehand what the position of the law is. And we felt that the body politic is the one primarily entrusted with that responsibility. They can either amend the statute to bring greater clarity either direction and leave it to states to choose whether they still want to be party to a particular approach that the Rome Statute takes on the matter. I regret to inform the committee that all our efforts, including setting aside a smaller structure where we were allowed to make representations, bore any fruit. And all we were asking for is greater legal certainty. We felt that we cannot be party to a system that mires in continued contradiction in terms of what it says and what it doesn't say in respect of political issues. And I'll not go into the detail of the actual formulation, etc. We also had difficulty with the manner in which the Judicial Chamber interpreted the Security Council resolution that led to a decision that Security Council resolution that was given a particular interpretation suggesting that the Security Council had effectively instructed in terms of the UN system that certain provisions of the Rome Statute be overridden so as to allow for, and I'm just paraphrasing this, to allow for the execution of the warrant against President al-Bashir. You may be aware that the Sudan is not party to the Rome Statute, and the Rome Statute itself does deal with the case of countries which are not party
statute in this regard. But the detail can be clarified further by the technical team that's present here. So we serve as a country that in the face of a situation where we seem to be expected to execute warrants for the arrest of sitting heads of state in circumstances where our interpretation of the Rome Statute speaks differently, especially in respect of member states who are not party to the Rome Statute, and yet confronted with a judgment to that effect at The Hague, which our interpretation is differs from an interpretation of our almost highest court on all other matters except constitutional matters, namely the Supreme Court of Appeal. We had difficulty in seeing our way clear by continuing to be part of that system, and especially in the light of us not having succeeded in obtaining the appropriate audience that we sought. Now, we then felt that this should not result in creating a vacuum in our justice system's ability to prosecute as South Africa, but to cooperate internationally in ensuring that there is no impunity in the world when it comes to the kind of serious crimes against humanity that are provided for under the Rome Statute, and hence to plug that gap that may arise as a result of us withdrawing from the Rome Statute, one, and two, therefore repealing the domestication law that domesticates the Roman, the Rome Statute, and thus makes it part of our domestic law, that we should come up with our own statute that provides for domestic and extraterritorial jurisdiction to prosecute this kind of heinous crimes. And that's what leads us before you today. The one last judgment I want to allude to relates to an application I think was brought by the DA and others that challenged our initial attempt based on our, obviously in hindsight, wrong interpretation of the Constitution. Wrong because we have also sought not to appeal that decision. That of saying that we could, as the executive, having launched the instrument with the ICC to become a member, and therefore believing it was our prerogative to actually take the initial step of withdrawing from the Rome Statute, the court found otherwise, that it was the appropriate procedure was for us to first come here and present our case to yourself and for yourselves to make that decision whether or not you approve the policy stance of government to be executed, that notice be given of our intended withdrawal, and that that matter be dealt with first before we can then proceed with all the other consequential steps, which would be to then repeal the Domestication Act and to substitute it with a new law, domestic law, as I've described earlier. So that is, in essence, the case that we presented before you, Chairperson. I thank you.
Minister, thank you for a comprehensive background, and I think that has empowered all of us to know where we are. And we have also before us a succinct briefing that has been
prepared by the department. Mrs. Pele, are you going to take us through it?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister, for taking us through the first portion of the matters that must be dealt with, which is the withdrawal from the ICC. This committee will note that we have tabled documents insofar as the withdrawal from the ICC is concerned in terms of Section 231 of the Constitution. And in doing so, we also tabled for introduction this bill, which I'm going to talk to. The two issues are linked to the other in the sense that when we withdraw from the, or should Parliament decide to withdraw from the ICC, we say that the bill must also be dealt with insofar as taking care of the gap that will be created in our law when we repeal the Implementation Act to ensure that South Africa does not become a safe haven for those who commit international crimes. So insofar as those two issues are linked, the two matters have been tabled, and the committee can deliberate on how it would deal with those two procedural matters, dealing with the withdrawal and then dealing with the bill. I will talk to the bill, and I move on to slide 3, which is the overview of the bill. The main aim of this bill is to criminalize conduct constituting international crimes. It provides for immunity from prosecution for international crimes in line with customary international law and the DIP Act, which is Diplomatic Immunities Act. While this bill deals with those matters and the criminalization of on criminalizing international crime, I must say that the bill also goes further in the sense that it corrects some issues in the Diplomatic Immunities Act and the issues that the Minister spoke to about the application of that act and how the Rome Statute was interpreted as against that specific piece of legislation. So we aim to bring greater clarity in the international crime scope. The second aim of the further aim of the bill is to grant extraterritorial jurisdiction to South African courts in respect of international crimes, to regulate the investigation of international crimes, to provide for the extradition of persons accused or convicted of international crimes to foreign states in terms of the Extradition Act, to provide for the surrender of persons accused or convicted of international crime to entities. We also provide for the cooperation with entities in respect of international crimes. We amend other laws which have a bearing on international crime, and we amend the Prevention and Combating of Torture of Persons Act to further regulate immunity relating to the crime of torture in line with the immunity provided in for international crimes in the bill. Most importantly, perhaps I should start with what we say in the schedule. In the schedule, we provide for the repeal of the entire Implementation Act, following on a decision taken by Parliament insofar as the withdrawal from the ICC is concerned. In moving on to Chapter 1 of the bill, we have a definition clause. One of the new matters that we deal with in this bill is we have to define the meaning of entity, and we include the International Criminal Court as an entity, meaning that insofar as the crimes are concerned, people may be surrendered to the entity, and the International Criminal Court is one of them. The objects are summarized in Clause 2, and I'm not going to deal with that at this stage. The application of the bill, Clause 3 regulates the application of the bill and provides for immunity from prosecutions for international crimes in accordance with customary international law and as provided for in the DIP Act. Chapter 2 deals with international crimes, read with Schedule 1, defines international crimes and criminalizes them in South Africa in line with the definitions in the ICC Act. Clause 5 confers local and under certain circumstances which correspond with the ICC Act, extraterritorial jurisdiction to South African courts. The High Court and Regional Courts may also impose life sentences to adjudicate international crimes. So he's saying that international crimes are regarded as extremely serious crimes. Clause 6 deals with the duty of the SAPS to investigate international crimes. When international crime has been conducted outside the Republic, the DPCI must conduct a preliminary investigation and on completion thereof submit its recommendation to the DPP for a decision as to whether a full investigation must be conducted. Clause 7 provides that international crimes may only be prosecuted with the written consent of the NDPP. The NDPP may review decisions to prosecute. The NDPP must account to Parliament for decisions regarding the institution of prosecution, including decisions not to prosecute. Chapter 2 of the Bill, Clause 8, provides that a court hearing an international crime must apply the Constitution and other domestic law and may, where appropriate, also consider and apply conventional and customary international law as well as comparable foreign law. This clause is a restatement of a provision of the ICC Act. Clause 9 excludes certain defences in respect of international crimes, some of which are based on Articles 28 and 33 of the Rome Statute and Section 42B of the ICC Act. Clause 10 provides for discretionary minimum sentences for international crimes. The ICC Act did not make provision for minimum sentences. The Criminal Law Amendment Act, dealing with discretionary minimum sentences, makes provision for discretionary minimum sentences for planned murder and rape, for example. Chapter 3 deals with extradition of persons to foreign states. Clause 11 regulates the extradition of a person to a foreign state for international crimes. It also provides that international crimes are deemed to be included in the definition of an extraditable offence in terms of Section 1 of the Extradition Act. It provides that international crimes are deemed to be included in extradition agreements concluded with foreign states. It makes the Extradition Act applicable to foreign states designated in terms of such act in respect of international crimes. Dr. Botha will take us onwards in the presentation from Chapter 4. Thank you very much, Chairperson. What is new is now Chapter 4, and it's new in the sense that it provides for the surrender of persons to entities. And as my colleague has already indicated, in terms of the definition of entity, it includes the International Criminal Court, which makes cooperation from South Africa with them still possible. So Clause 12 of the Bill provides that a person who committed an international crime may be surrendered by the Republic to an entity. The problem is because of the fact that the Extradition Act only relates to the extradition of persons to states, you cannot use that act to extradite them or surrender a person to an entity. Hence, we have to make some of the sections of the Extradition Act applicable to the surrender of persons to entities. Then you will see that on Clause 13, it deals with the procedure, the form of request, and the information and documentation which must accompany a request for surrender. And this clause is substantially in line with Article 91 of the Rome Statute. Then in terms of Chapter 4, or further in terms of Chapter 4 of the Bill, you will come to Clause 14. That is where the DG may request additional information if the request did not, for the surrender of the person, did not contain sufficient information. And in terms of Clause 15, it, on the other hand, obliges the DG to notify, because the DG is almost like the central authority in this whole process, then the DG must notify an entity of any decision taken in the RSA in respect of that request, and where the request is refused, provision has been made that reason must be provided for the refusal. And as I indicated, the Extradition Act in itself is not applicable to the surrender of persons to entities. Through this bill, we make certain provisions of the Extradition Act applicable to, of course, with the required changes to the request for surrender. These sections of the Extradition Act deals with the warrant of arrest issued by a magistrate, and that's the way
by means of which you can get the person before a magistrate so that there's an inquiry, and then after the decision of the minister whether or not the person must be further detained, and then whether the person must be surrendered. Now, further, in terms of Chapter 4 of the Bill, and specifically Clause 17, you will see there that thereafter we make provision for certain circumstances. If on the date on which the person should have been surrendered to the entity, that has not happened, and how do you deal then with the matter forward? Then in terms of Clause 18, what is important, it contains two aspects. It provides for the postponement of a request for surrender and for temporary surrender. Now, Article 94 of the Rome Statute also makes provision for the postponement of the request if the request may interfere with an ongoing investigation that's pending in the Republic. But what is new, Chair, is the temporary surrender of a person for purposes of prosecuting the person for an international crime, because in many of our extradition agreements, we do make provision for such a case. In terms of Clause 90, it's about the provision of information by the entity relating to progress made with the proceedings against the person surrendered. And then Clause 20 regulates the cost incurred in respect of a request for surrender. Normally what will happen is we will arrest the person here, we will carry that cost, we will have the hearing, and we will do all these related processes. That will be our cost. But the question of the costs relating to the surrender of that person will be borne by the entity. And this is also based on Article 100 of the Rome Statute. Now, Clause 21 empowers the minister to determine matters and conditions relevant to the surrender of a person which are not provided for in Chapter 4. As far as possible, we try to make provision for all the aspects and the procedures, but there may be one or two aspects that we've not made provision for, and then we deemed it necessary to give the minister that power just to deal with that condition by means of a certain procedure. Then Clause 22 regulates the situation where an extradition request and a request for surrender, or multiple requests for surrender from different entities, are received. This provision is similar to Article 90. Let me try to explain. Just that there's still this issue that the national states must prosecute. If they don't want to prosecute, they must surrender, extradite. So first of all, we also try, like Ms. Belay indicated, we will still go on with extradition of persons who are charged with international crimes to go and surrender them to other foreign states requesting that. But in this instance, you may get a situation where this accused person is sought by a state and an entity, and it's just this clause is about how do you then deal with the different reports. Then in terms of Chapter 5, this is request for assistance to and from entities. Because of the fact that the statute covers a wide range of issues, it does not only criminalise certain conduct and define the conduct, it also provides then for the extradition part, but in addition for legal assistance. So in trying to ensure that continued legal assistance to entities, we've made provision for that in Chapter 5. And we've done that more or less in line with the International Criminal Cooperation Matters Act, which most of the provisions are to be found in the, or similar provisions in the ICC Act as well. So therefore, as Clause 25 provides for different forms of assistance to entities, including identification and whereabouts of persons or location of items, serving of documents, provision of information, documents, records, and the taking of evidence and obtaining of statements. And this provision is substantially in line with Section 24 of the ICC Act and Article 93 with Article 99 of the Rome Statute. But it's true that it is not as comprehensive as the assistance as provided for in the ICCM Act. For instance, not to say that we're not going to declare South Africa as a prison where a person convicted of international crimes by an entity can serve his or her sentence because of the reasons that we know about how the situation in the prison. Then clause 25 deals with the form of the request for assistance and the information and documentation which must accompany the request. Clause 26 of the bill provides that section 7 of the ICCM Act, which deals with a foreign request for assistance in obtaining evidence, that section is also applicable. And in terms of this clause also, the DG is conferred upon certain obligations. First of all, the DG must cause the request to be executed by relevant authorities, inform the entity of the possible delays in responding to requests, inform an entity of any decision not to comply with the request, and provide reasons for a decision not to execute the request. Then in terms of clause 27, a provision is made for the service of process and documents and for the transmission of a return of service to an entity, and this clause you will see is similar to section 21 of the ICC Act. Then clause 28 provides that a request for assistance may be refused, and it may be refused if the execution of the request will adversely affect the Republic's sovereignty, security, public order, or an essential public interest, or when it's contrary to any law of the Republic. But the request for assistance can also be postponed, and it may be postponed if it may interfere with an ongoing investigation or prosecution in the Republic. Similarly, you will see there the clause that reads corresponding in Article 93.4, read with Article 72 of the Rome Statute, as well as Article 94. Now, clause 29, we're still busy now with the legal assistance to entities. You will get a provision making Section 8, which deals with examination of witnesses, Section 9, which deals with the rights and privileges of witnesses, and Section 10, which deals with offences by witnesses of the ICCM Act that's made applicable to the examination of a witness in respect of a request for assistance. Then in Clause 30, you will see we've made Section 11 of the ICCM Act also applicable, dealing with the attendance of witnesses in foreign states, and there you will see also this is in line with Section 20 of the ICC Act and a certain article of the Rome Statute. You would have noticed that in our object memo, wherever we refer to provisions of other legislation that we made applicable in this bill, we would have given an indication of what these sections are about. And then Section 31 is more like an administrative issue. It deals with the authentication of documents. And then once again, similar to the previous clause that regulates the cost relating to a request for surrender, we've got a clause here that deals with a request for or cost relating to the request for assistance, and it's once again based on an article in the Rome Statute. Then clause 33, similar to the previous clause, clause 21 that I've explained to you, we also give the minister the power to determine matters and conditions relevant to the assistance which are not provided for in Chapter 5. And then clause 34 deals with the situation where the RSA requests assistance from an entity where an investigation or criminal or other proceedings which have a bearing on an international crime is being instituted within the RSA. So normally with the other agreements, like extradition agreements, you have that mutual assistance. I will surrender to you and you will surrender to me. This is actually the flip side of the coin where we say we would like to make provision in this bill also that if we have an investigation pending here and there's something that, some evidence that the entity has, that we are in a position to get that legal assistance as well. So that is something that I just thought I can highlight. And then Chapter 6 of the bill deals with the miscellaneous issue. Clause 35, normally the power given the power to the minister to make regulations regarding certain aspects. Then clause 36, my colleague has already indicated to you that in that schedule, that is where eventually we make provision for the repeal of the ICC Act. But you also would have seen that in that schedule, we are going to amend a few of other legislation, for instance, section 18 of the CPA, which deals with the prescription of offences. We're going to change the RICO Act, but all of that has to do with making sure or ensuring that we make provision for international crimes as a serious offence in different pieces of legislation, so that all these provisions that are about serious offences then can apply also to international crime. And then, as she also indicated, we're going to change the law relating to torture to bring it in line with what we are suggesting in Clause 3 of the bill. And then Clause 37 deals with the short title and commencement, namely that the Act will not come into operation when it's published, but on a date fixed by the President by proclamation. And this is to ensure that the Act comes in operation on the date on which the withdrawal from the road statute takes effect, which is at least 12 months after receipt of the notice, if that happens. And then just an indication, Chair, that there is a sales, the final sales was approved, and the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor has certified the bill.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think the Minister's background and the presentation were very clear, succinct. Any comments from the Honourable members?
Thank you so much for the presentation, Honourable Minister. Mine is just a clarity seeking question in terms of chapter 4, surrender of persons to entities. One of the entities mentioned there is International Criminal Court. In that respect, will the said court still have a role to play in terms of this bill?
Any other?
Is there any entity on the African continent? It's just the International Criminal Court.
Let me start with the first question, and the officials can clarify further. You see, we are not enemies of the ICC. And we do not envisage ourselves completely disconnected with the ICC. Remember, the Rome Statute itself has the principle of complementarity, which is that in any case, before you refer a matter to the ICC under the current statute, you must first exhaust your own internal remedies first. And if your law allows you to even prosecute here, they'll give you the technical support. So we envisage a situation where we might still need that kind of technical support when we deal with some of the issues, including even being able to refer matters. The only difference, it will be on our terms this time around, in terms of our own law, because the only small issue that has caused all of this, to be crude about it, is that we're being asked to be the first country on earth to ever arrest a sitting head of state who visits in good faith on official business that relates to diplomatic relations or participating in a diplomatic context. We're not even talking about somebody coming in a private capacity to come on a holiday or something like that.
because if you look at DEEPA, the way it works is that you must first have conferral of diplomatic immunity on the basis of the official business that brings you here. So we can't afford a situation where, you know, as the English say, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Why are the British, why are the Americans not prepared to do that which everybody else expects us to do, where nobody else in the world has ever done it and doesn't seem to be willing to do it? So this is the politics of this thing. And we say we're not foolish enough to do things that will literally make us make history in the world, that a system that has endured for over 1,000 years, which has enabled the diplomatic system in the world to actually work, because otherwise nations would never visit each other unless you guarantee that they are envoys when they come here. There are many South Africans who have committed offenses elsewhere in the world as diplomats who could not be prosecuted, whose civil action could not be taken against them because of the system, etc., etc. So that is the context that I thought I needed to explain. But I think the officials would elaborate further on the continental issue. The Malabo protocol is meant to be the replica of the ICC. There has been issues of constitutionality and other issues that have been the subject of controversy when it comes to it needs at least 30 countries to ratify it for it to come into operation, I think. And so far there were about how many, 12 or something, who at least have signed. I think there's a few.
Seven have signed, but nobody has ratified.
So we agreed at the last meeting of ministers of justice, which is a substructure of the AU in Addis, that we commission a study to visit each country to understand their peculiar difficulties with it, so that we can come back and look at whether we shouldn't either revise it or come with a new instrument that would be more acceptable and that would be in harmony with the domestic constitutional dispensations of different countries, so that we are able to develop our own homegrown mechanisms that will enable us to deal effectively with impunity in Africa. I think the stance really of our own country is that we should never be misunderstood to be tolerant of or promoting impunity. But of course, where you have a situation such as this, you really have to be responsive. Otherwise, you'll just undermine your own policies and outlook.
Thank you. Thank you, Minister. I think everything is clear. Any other input? Honourable Minister, thank you for the briefing. I guess the honourable members are happy. That brings us to the end of the briefing.
I'm going to go for public comment.